At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And Duff McKagan got you covered every week, each week, with the joke of the week.
Hello, Chris Jericho. It's Duff McKagan calling you. I'm just about to take off on my grand Malaysian, Asian, African tour. Thinking of taking off, you know, I think about my family these days. And I remember my grandpa's last words, Chris Jericho, my grandpa's last words were very well. I remember them. They're something like this. Quit shaking that ladder, you little shit. Okay, thank you very much. Goodbye.
That was actually pretty good. I like that one. Thanks, as always, to Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Duff McKagan for kicking off the weekend with a laugh. He hasn't let us down yet. Over a year, every Friday, delivering a joke, no matter where he is around the world. I think he's in Jakarta now or something like that. Always delivering, always closing. Someone else you can always count on to be delivering and closing is the legendary, amazing bass player, great guy, my good friend Rudy Sarzo. I mean, Rudy has played with everybody, if you're talking about heavy metal and rock and roll. He played in the original Quiet Riot. Then he went to Ozzy Osbourne's solo band with the late, great Randy Rhoads. Then he returned to Quiet Riot for the Mental Health record. Then he played in Whitesnake for the 1987 record. Then he played with Dio, Ronnie James Dio. He played with Yngwie Malmsteen. He's playing now, he was in the Blue Oyster Cult. He's playing now with the Guess Who. He's everywhere. He also helped Beatles drummer Ringo Starr move from one house to another. Great story there. These days, he's playing in the Guess Who, like I said. They're on the road. They're always touring. Their tour starts November 11th in Miami, Florida. Get your tickets at theguesswho.com. Great Canadian band, great Winnipeg band. Rudy's now an honorary Winnipegger. Great, great guy, though. Rudy's also got his own podcast. It's called The Dash. He talks to all type of interesting musicians about their life's journey in music. He's had Lexi Fox from Steel Panther, Frankie Benali from Quiet Riot. So many great shows. Go give it a listen and subscribe at Apple Podcasts. Leave him a 5-star rating and review while you're there. Do the same thing for Talk is Jericho. And sit back and relax and hear some great rock and roll stories from the legendary Rudy Sarzo right here on Talk is Jericho. So I feel like we're fancy pants now. We're here in the studio in Westwood One with me and Rudy Sarzo. And you've done this show before with Frankie.
That's right.
But it's the
show.
My show, yeah.
Yes.
But it's the first time you and me were together, just you and me. And I'm excited about this because I've been waiting for a long time to talk to you, man.
Yeah, I'm very excited about it, especially since I'm an honorary Canadian now, since I'm a member of the Guess Who.
That's so random. That's one thing I love about your career, and I want to talk about all of it. You've played with so many bands, but how did you end up in the Guess Who?
It's really a roundabout way. Actually, it started the path towards me joining the Guess Who started like maybe 4 years ago.
Uh-huh.
I was touring with the Jeff Tate version of Queensryche.
Right.
And they bring in Sass Jordan,
mm-hmm,
to perform the part of Mary because we were performing the whole Operation Mindcrime, right?
Right.
You know. So I have known Sass from years before, but never really got, you know, once you're in the same tour bus, you really get to know a person,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's such an incredible talent and also an incredible person, too,
mm-hmm,
you know. And it just so happens that her husband Derek Sharp is the lead singer, has been the lead singer with the Guess Who for like over 10, 12 years.
Okay.
You know, so it came a point that they were looking for a bass player. And this happened like maybe a year and a half ago. And they called me up, you know. So I said, hey, to Derek, why don't you call Rudy? And then they called me up, and I've been a fan of the Guess Who since, you know, since I was a kid.
Right.
You know, music on the radio. It's my, as a matter of fact, when we play on stage, all these songs, they bring up memories of crazy girlfriends that I had in high school. You know? So people, you know, like the guys from the band say, hey, what were you laughing during the song? It's because I just...
Why were you laughing during laughing?
That's right. Because it reminds me of a crazy girlfriend that I had when the song came out, you know. And so, yeah, I've been, the Jim Cale, the founding member bassist of the band, he's retired from the road life, and he passed me the torch. We're actually, they were doing a show in Las Vegas, so he brings me up on stage, and he says, this, Rudy Sarge is going to be taking over my spot from now on. So I did one song, got off the stage, and he finished the show.
And that was it?
That was it.
So was that the last original member of the Guess Who?
No, Gary Peterson, the drummer.
Is he still drumming?
Oh, God, yeah.
Okay, gotcha, right.
Yeah, and, you know, besides playing with Choir Ryan with Frankie Benali, this is the other band that I've actually got to play with an original drummer. And that makes such a difference, because it's you're actually locking into what the original feel and rhythm, intent, foundation of the song is all about.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, it's not an interpretation watered down from like, you know, five generations of different percussionists coming into the group. You know, especially if you're playing with a classic rock lineup, you know, and some, you know, a band that's been around since, you know, 60s or 70s or whatever. It's, you know, it's very hard to find all the original components, you know, in the group. And this really gives me an opportunity to get the sense of the real deal.
It's so interesting, too, because there's always people that talk about, you know, and most people don't even know. You go play in front of crowds, they would think, oh, it's the Guess Who. And obviously Burton Cummings isn't in the band. But the other guys, people don't care. They just want to hear the songs. And to me, it's like when you talk about the purists who go, well, there's no Burton, there's no Randy Bachman. I'd rather have a band playing those songs and have the Guess Who still in the world than not doing those songs at all.
Yes, I completely agree with you. And even though every single founding member of the group is still with us, you know, somebody mentioned to me about a week ago something that really makes encapsulates what is going to be occurring in the music industry as time goes on and people leave us behind, you know. And it's the music will keep the dead alive.
Right. Like I was even thinking about that with AC/DC now that Malcolm's passed away and Brian is retired. Even Axl and Angus, it's still AC/DC. You still want to go to the show. And like you said, that music does take you back to the crazy girlfriends in high school and all these other great memories that you have for your entire life.
Yeah, but you know, this is great because not only are you a superstar in wrestling, you're a rock star. So I can, you know, talk to you in
terms relate
that
to it.
I can relate to it.
Yeah.
As a band member, you know, you have your band. And whether it's you or the guys in the band, you know, we have responsibilities to keep what we have created going alive, whether a member leaves the group or he passes on. You know, we're giving that responsibility. You know, I wish I would have understood that over 35 years ago when Randy Rhoads passed, because I would have not left Ozzy. But I didn't know how to deal with it.
You couldn't play an Ozzy without Randy on stage with you.
No, it was incredibly painful. Now, anytime that I have an opportunity, like, you know, we do these Randy Rhoads tributes, and it gives me an opportunity to not only celebrate his memory, but continue on the responsibility that we, that played the music, that we were his friends, his bandmates, to carry the torch on behalf of his compositions, his musicianship, and his friendship.
You know, it's interesting. Sting said this when the Police got back together. He said, like, the music doesn't belong to us, the band, anymore. It belongs to the people. And it's our responsibility to continue to play those songs for those reasons that you just said.
Absolutely.
Did you I mean, and obviously you never know this at the time because you're, you know, a young kid in your 20s. And for you, obviously, you've told the story many times about Randy passing away in the car, in the plane crash. Mm-hmm. Did you know when you were playing with Randy that he was one of those guys like a like an Eddie Van Halen that 30 years from now would still be critically acclaimed? Or was it just another day at work getting on stage and playing with your friend?
Well, I mean, it's very hard, you know, when you're having such a significant moment on stage to think beyond that moment because you want to relish that. You don't want to think about yesterday. You don't want to think about the future. You want to think about what's going on now. And I knew at the moment, every single night that we were playing, that it was going to be something that people would still be talking about years to come.
Mm-hmm.
That I knew, but it wasn't something that I was living in. That wasn't what I was enjoying about the moment. I was enjoying the energy, the now, the now. Now we're playing. Now we're on stage, and it's, you know, Ozzy and Tommy Aldridge, and then later on Don Airey, and of course Randy, and there's all these great songs. And look at the crowd; it's grown from last year when we started with the Blizzard of Oz, and you know, to like sometimes half full. And then the word of mouth started. You know, this is before MTV. You know, so it was all word of mouth, and people are just like, not only are they loving it, they're like, they can't believe what they're actually witnessing. Mm-hmm. It's something so different from anything else out there, you know. And yes, that was what I was breathing in as I was performing on stage.
And it was a great rock and roll band, too.
Oh, just my God.
What a chemistry.
Every single night was the Super Bowl.
You know? Tell me a couple stories from reading your book. There's some great stories in there. When you guys were putting together the stage show, Ozzy's stage show at this point in time, and trying to do a couple of production gimmicks and some of the problems that happened during
that
time.
You know, it wasn't as much as a gimmick as it was about, again, you know, it's a great band. So if a great band needs a great production to match it and give that to the audience, and how different can we be? And when I say that, this is I'm speaking on behalf of Sharon because that's all that's going through her head.
Right.
You know, how can we take this to the next level, to a place that nobody else has been to? Because, you know, we had the music to back it up.
Right.
It wasn't all about you know, that. So at the beginning, you know, it became kind of like a challenge to Randy because, you know, he walks on, you know, on our first day of pre-production for the Diary of a Madman tour, and we have the castle set up, and he's like, nobody's ever seen anything like that. We have a freaking castle on stage. I mean, like a real life size.
And
castle.
If you can see some of the video from this, it is a great looking stage, our castle.
Yeah,
with the drums kind of up high.
Yes, yes. Well, it was actually castle stairs leading to this platform where a throne would appear. You know, when the kabuki curtains will fall down,
right?
And just thing appears, and then there was a magician that created that effect where you know, you have an empty throne, and then all of a sudden, poof, there's Ozzy there. Yeah. You know, and it was like there had never been anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then we start playing, and it's like, holy crap! It was so much sensory overload,
right?
You know, happening that, I mean, people still talk about it, you know, 35 years later. And it was, and to be on stage with that, it was like the most amazing roller coaster ride you could ever imagine. Right? Mm-hmm. You just got to do hang on.
Yeah. The kabuki curtain came down every night the way it was supposed
to? Except for the first night. For those who are listening who are not aware what a kabuki curtain is, it's a curtain that doesn't draw. Mm-hmm. It just drops.
Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the show, you'll see it just drop.
It just drops.
Kiss uses it. Motley Crue uses it.
Yeah. And it's like the quickest way for a curtain to disappear. It just drops, and then, you know, stagehands just pull it off to the side from the ground. It's on the ground. So the show already starts, you know. And somebody forgot to plug in the rod, the motor to the rod that turns the rod. That it's got the actual curtain has like, what do you call it?
Little rings?
Rings and then pins. The pins are on the rod and the rings are on the curtain. So when the rod faces down, you know, faces the ground, that releases the curtains.
Right.
You know, massive curtains. Yeah. You know? So somebody forgot to plug it in and it was chaos.
So you guys are playing with the curtain still up?
Well, this is what happened. You know, Ozzy is inside of the throne.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this he's got like, it was basically vertical vines. We call that, you know, the ones that you release and it goes.
Yeah.
They disappear, you know, the old fashioned. And so he was, you know, he was like sitting there with like a series of them that were plugging into like a very rustic system of like you push a button and these things are released, you know.
Right. Right?
But as they were released, there was a flash of smoke.
Mm-hmm.
So it happened behind the smoke. Mm-hmm. So boom, there you are. There's Ozzy, you know. And I saw this because the way that we did it was Randy and I appear on stage through portcullises. You know, we have like our own
like
entry.
The gates, yeah.
The gates,
yeah. In the castle.
The gates were lifted. So we're like standing there watching this whole thing unfold in front of us because we were literally on stage but behind the castle gates, you know. And then the castle gates come up. There was all plastics. Halloween, basically. Yeah, right. But it looked great.
Yeah.
The castle was not. The castle was really solid, you know, but all the doodads, you know, like the mm-hmm. gates
plastic,
and stuff like
yeah.
that. Yeah. They were, you know, supposed to be iron chains.
Yeah.
They were not. But anyways, so I'm there. I'm like, you know, and everything is guided by musical cues. We had the Diary of a Madman intro, you know, with Randy playing the wreck from the record, cueing certain things that were about to happen. You know, one of them is where the curtain comes down. The next one is Ozzy lets go of this curtain blinds, you know, and appears and smoke. And all this happened except that the curtain never came down. So this was going on, you know, as planned. And Ozzy sees the curtain and he grabs a black plexiglass cross, massive cross. That was a prop, and he grabs it and kind of like the Exorcist, you know, like
he's trying to will the curtain down.
The power of the Ozzy compels you to drop the curtain. Yeah, he's running around the stage doing that. You know, meanwhile there's panic. It's like freaking chaos. I look at one point and Sharon's like beating the crap out of the guy who designed, you know, the whole thing, and then all of a sudden because. What happens is there's the music, the intro, and then there's quiet because it ended. We were supposed to be playing by now. And you know what happens when there's silence? You start hearing, boom! And the booms get louder and louder. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, we got to send, you know, a rigger, you know, one of the guys right. that set things up from the ceiling to go up to across the curtain and pin by pin undo the curtain.
It's falling one ring at a time.
One ring at a time. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that was our first show. Cow Palace, December 30th, 1981.
Isn't it great? Like when you watch the movie Spinal Tap as a musician, even as a wrestler, they nailed it only in a way that you have to be in the business to understand how close they nailed it.
It was genius.
Yeah.
It was I went to watch the movie with my wife, and we looked at each other, and at the end, we go, what is this?
Yeah.
Because we didn't know that it was comedy.
Yeah.
It was too close to home.
Right, yeah, it wasn't very funny, right?
It wasn't funny. It was like, and?
You posted a great picture the other day after Fast Eddie Clark passed away
yeah.
of you and Lemmy and, yeah. and Filthy, and you talked about how you guys yeah. went on tour with Motorhead, Ozzy and Motorhead. There must have been some crazy stories from that time frame with Ozzy and Lemmy
yeah.
leading the charge.
Well, yes, they were, and then they stopped quickly because see, Sharon needed to keep Ozzy away from any temptations because
mm-hmm.
he could get into trouble all by himself. You know, he didn't need,
right.
he need a you know any assistance in doing that. And of course, you know, Motorhead, they have their own real metal.
Yeah.
Lifestyle. And, you know, for me, I grew up playing in Miami, which was more of a loungy club, you know, type of environment. Then I went to the Midwest and I got a glimpse of like, okay, this is more Midwestern rock metal, you know. Then I moved to L.A. and the Sunset Strip. So that to me became kind of like more of like the real deal. But no, that nothing prepared me for Motorhead because they are the architects,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
of true True Metal,
yeah.
you know, of them and Judas Priest and so on, right? So here I am, you know, some kid off the Sunset Strip, you know, I know nothing. I hadn't even been to England yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I meet the guys in the band. For about a week, I couldn't tell who was the crew and who was the musicians. But they all wore the same patches and, you know, Motorhead.
Jean jacket and jeans.
Jean jacket, yeah. Yeah, and it was a summer tour, so Lemmy wore his shorts.
Daisy Duke shorts.
Daisy Duke. But he pulled it off, you know. And so I couldn't even understand what they were talking, you know, because I wasn't used to the English accent.
Thick English accent,
yeah, really
too.
Thick, you know. And I just used to stare into Lemmy's eyes because they would be like blown out from not sleeping for about 3 days. But he was the most well-read individual I've ever met.
Mm.
On the road, you know, he would get off the bus to, you know, to wash up. And he would have like this small bag with books, paperback sticking out, and a bottle of vodka with just enough orange juice to make it off. That'd be completely white. You know, yeah, I think that's how he got his vitamins.
Right. You know. His vitamin C.
Yeah, probably took a eyedropper and of orange juice and just put it in there.
Right.
And then he's like, good morning, and blah, 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 blah. You know, it was like,
off we go.
Yeah, it was kind of like hanging out with pirates.
Literally, right.
Literally. Yeah. I mean, because that was an English crew, our crew, English, the sound and lights crew, English, and then you got Motorhead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like, wow, this is really like hanging out with pirates, and which is fine because I am from the Caribbean.
You're kind of one too, like a Spanish pirate.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, every time, like when you go on tour, guys always, you know, I always hang out with my bass player and the drummer and the guitar player always go along. Did you have that with Randy? Was that the guy you would get off and go look around with?
Yeah, because basically it came down to this. Tommy Aldridge had been around since Black Oak, Arkansas, and Pat Travers and all that. He had his own tour going on.
He had his stops, his ports in the storm.
And he had, you know, a little black book, you know, 81.
Miss Arkansas, there's Little Rock, yeah.
That's right, you know, yeah. And he was like, you know, we were like checking into a hotel day off, and he was like, say, see you guys, see you at soundcheck tomorrow, and some beautiful woman would come and pick him up. That was it. So now you got Randy, Ozzy, Sharon, and me. And Sharon would spend most of the time in the room making phone calls, you know, doing business. She was incredible, you know. And then you have Ozzy, especially at the very beginning, hanging out at the bar with the crew, the guys from the crew. And until Sharon decided that, no, he was getting into much trouble, and then we're going to keep the crew and the band apart, you know, which meant that that it was basically Ozzy and Randy and me.
Right, that's it.
Sitting at the bar.
Did you and Randy ever go look around? Did you ever remember looking around to sights and stuff?
It was Randy's first major U.S. tour, because he had already toured with Ozzy in the U.K. and I believe some European shows too. And then, you know, he came back to the United States. So really outside of L.A., Randy wasn't very familiar, you know, with the rest of America. So where did we go? We just went to malls. Hang out at the mall.
Hang around the mall, right?
Hang around the mall, yeah.
Yeah,
we saw more malls than, you know.
What do you miss the most about Randy 35 years later? Can you remember
everything. He was so, I mean, when I think of Randy, I just don't think about what an incredible musician, composer he was. He was just an incredible friend, human being. Very, very steady. Steady, not only as far as somebody that you could trust as a person and as a musician, but also he had a certain zen about him. That no matter how things were crazy around him, he wouldn't be caught into that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was always something that I could look at and say, okay, he's not freaking out, so okay, I can deal with this.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Do you think? And it's always hard to predict this, but I've read before that Ozzy said he probably would have stopped playing rock and roll and went to play classical music or something along those lines. Do you think you guys would have continued as this lineup of the band for a long time to come?
You know, just as a reference, I can use Zakk Wylde's relationship with Ozzy and the band. You know, I would think it would have been probably something like that, where Randy would have had his own career, but also he would go in and out of the Aussie band, mm-hmm. you know, whenever it would be, you know,
yeah.
good for
whenever
both
he was
sides.
Touring or whatever, yeah.
yeah. Yeah.
How about for you? Were you happy playing in Aussie until Randy passed away?
Yeah. Yes. Yes, 1,000%.
Gotcha.
They were incredible with me.
Right, know? Right. So when you, I want to talk to you about Quiet Riot and not the obvious, but the fact that Quiet Riot, we've talked about the US Festival before, and I watched it all the time. It's one of my favorite gigs. You guys just killed it on that day. Another great rock and roll band with Carlos Cavazo having to replace Randy Rhoads, but still doing a great job in a different way. But Quiet Riot was so big, and then burned out so fast. Mm-hmm. What do you think the reasons for that were, and how was that for you? Once again, you know how hard it is for lightning to strike twice in this business. You go from Ozzy, a huge band, right into another huge band, and then that one kind of flames up very quickly.
Yeah, well, one of the things that before it completely fizzled out, I left.
Oh right, yeah, you left before three, I think. Quite right, three, right? Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I gave notice. Before we went on tour for the 1984 tour, the Condition Critical tour, and I couldn't walk away from the tour because once I make a commitment.
Yeah, and you were on that tour because I saw it. Yeah,
I have to follow through. You know, everything was ready to go and papers were signed. You know, certain dates with the promoters and stuff like that. So I survived that tour emotionally until it was fulfilled, and then I moved on. What do I think about that is, talking about Carlos, I never saw Carlos as a replacement for Randy. First of all, because I couldn't really look at anybody replacing Randy.
Of course.
To me, he was a replaceable.
Yeah.
Whether it was in Ozzy or in Quiet Riot, you know, what became known as the mental health version of Quiet Riot.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it was a brand new situation. You know, and I went from playing with Ozzy to the complete unknown, just based on the fact that I was looking for joy.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to bring joy back in my playing again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was the most important thing.
Sure.
You know? Yeah, to me, what I do is at certain points in my life, when I at crossroads, I talk to my 18-year-old me.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
You know, and
what do you say?
What do I say? I listen a lot.
Hmm.
You know,
to your 18-year-old you,
yeah,
who will tell you?
No, who created this?
Right, but who will tell you follow your heart or follow your instincts or play because you love it or
everything? And most important, fight for what you believe in.
Right.
Not only fight, but first you got to find that purpose that you must fight for the rest of your life. You know what I mean? We humans, and I believe also all the creatures on this planet. You know, we were born, first we were sperm.
Mm-hmm.
We fought with every other millions of sperms for that one.
Yeah.
We are it.
Yeah.
Each one of us. You know, so having accomplished that, the universe, and I'm using universe because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to leave out anybody else that thinks I've said it. I'm a Christian, but I don't want to leave out anybody else.
In case anybody listening from Grimlock or Mars, including you as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And we're entrusted here with certain, you know, to fulfill a purpose. And as we grow up, there'll be little voices in our heads giving us ideas. Hey, how about this purpose, this and that? People like to call it dreams. You know, obviously you had two major dreams. Not everybody does that.
Right.
Can you imagine the level of success you've been able to achieve with two purposes?
Mm-hmm. Because I listen to those little voices.
Yes, you do.
A lot of people don't.
Yes, yes.
Ah, yeah. I understand.
Yeah. And that to me, without listening to those voices and finding that purpose, and you're going to fight for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's other people getting those little voices too that might conflict with your will. You know, I want to accomplish this. Or I want to accomplish that too. So you're competing. It might be a friendly competition because at some point you are going to meet.
Mm-hmm.
You might be best friends or best rivals. And they're all the same.
Right.
They both bring the best out of you.
Interesting.
You know?
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
Yeah. So at certain points in my life, I go back to that. And I replenish myself with the purpose, realign my purpose, and the fight, the energy, the strength, the faith, the faith. To me, it comes down to faith.
Sure.
The faith is what's going to give you the energy, the power to fight.
But you know when it's time. Like you said, with after Randy passing, you weren't enjoying with Ozzy. Then mm-hmm. you go to Quiet Riot. You said you left before or right before the condition critical because you weren't enjoying it. Is it more important to you, and obviously it is, to enjoy what you're doing rather than having the steady gig and the paycheck?
Yeah. The yeah. enjoyment is the reward you get for a fight well fought.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. I don't think you'll be having the success you have all these years without that enjoyment.
Right. You know what's interesting is that you remind me right now with something Brent Fitz said, a mutual friend of ours. Mm-hmm. He said, Rudy's very zen. Mm-hmm. And you just said that about Randy. You've now become what you said Randy was to this new generation of musicians and players.
It's a work in progress because as you have to realign yourself, and sometimes you find yourself in a place that you have to get out of and get you back on path again and find that zen. You know, zen can be very elusive.
Sure.
You know.
Just to go quickly about Kevin Gibeau, do you think he's underrated as a frontman?
Oh, absolutely.
I think he's one of the best rock and roll front bands from that generation.
Absolutely. I think that Frankie finally has found somebody who can actually do justice to the memory of Kevin's and Quiet Riot.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
James Durbin, right?
Yeah, James Durbin. Absolutely.
Yeah, I found that watching that US Festival. I mean, Kevin, man, he's a great singer, great front man. He really he really had it down.
Yes, absolutely. You know? Great, great rock front man. Especially, you know, of the guys that came out of the Sunsets.
Mm-hmm. His thing was he just liked to talk a lot. He would always be very boastful and talk a lot of shit in a lot of ways. I think that might have got him in trouble maybe, right?
Yeah, but I think, you know, now we have social media.
Mm-hmm.
Today with social media, people will have a deeper access and better understanding of what Kevin was coming from rather than being left to the press to grab certain quotes from a interview or conversation or whatever, because it's always the
clickbait nowadays.
That's right. That's what's going to get your attention. That's what's going to get printed.
Did you guys ever talk to him about that, or did he ever mention it? Like, dude, calm down a bit. Don't say this stuff. Or did he ever say they took those words and they put them out of
context? No,
because
we knew.
Yeah.
We knew what was going on, and we knew that he wanted the press wanted to interview him just because of all of the things that he was going to be saying.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your relationship with you and Tommy Aldridge, which I think is very interesting. Also, people don't really think about it much. You guys played together in the glory years of Ozzy, probably the best lineup he's had. Then there's the famous Project Driver album, which I did have, which was also you and Tommy as well.
So you're the one who bought that record. I was wondering who the hell bought this.
It was, I even remember, Rob Rock, Tony McAlpine, Aldridge, and Sarzo. And that's why I bought it, because of Aldridge and Sarzo. Mm-hmm. And then you guys end up in Whitesnake together as well. How was that connection with you guys always being together? Was it a coincidence, or did one guy get the gig and bring in the other guy?
And then there was another band, Manic Eden.
Oh,
which
wow.
It was Ron Young from Little Caesar and not the pizzeria, but the band. And Adrian Vandenberg. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. It just felt so natural for me to play with Tommy. I mean, once I locked in with Tommy, it was natural. I mean, you know, we try to put a band together between the Ozzy years and my Quiet Riot. You know, he left Ozzy, I left Quiet Riot, and we spent like a couple of years, which is when we got to record the Mars Project, you know, that one that you're talking about with Tony McAlpine and Rob Rock. And then we joined Whitesnake.
Did you join together?
Yes, we did.
As a team?
Yeah, as
interesting.
A rhythm section.
On whose recommendation?
Well, David already knew Tommy. And Whitesnake was the opening band for Quiet Riot in 1984.
That's right. It was Kick Axe, Whitesnake, and Quiet Riot in Winnipeg that I saw, right?
Yeah, and so, as a matter of fact, the last day of the tour, we're having like a little celebration, you know, farewell, you know, to Whitesnake from the tour. And David hugs me and whispers in my ear, "Someday we're going to play together, darling," you know. and I'm going, how does he know that I'm leaving the band? Because I was leaving the band, but I didn't tell anybody. Because,
right.
You know, what's the point, you know? And then when it became official that I was, I had left Quiet Riot, I get a call from management, Whitesnake management. And we were asked, Tommy Aldridge and I, we were asked to actually join the band. And personally, I didn't, because there were still certain conflicts going on within that configuration mm-hmm. that actually went, that was touring, you know.
The Quiet Riot configuration?
No.
The Whitesnake.
The Whitesnake configuration. And I didn't want to, you know, leave one bad situation for another. Didn't make any sense.
You're talking about like the conflict between Coverdale and John Sykes?
That's... you want to go there, yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, you didn't want to leave one. I gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing to do with the music.
Yeah.
You know, to me, they're an incredible partnership.
But once again, Rudy, you just said this earlier. It's not, listen, there's a lot of great musicians, and you get that chemistry, but it's how you react with each other on a 12-hour bus ride or on the plane or whatever it may be. That's where you decide who your band guys are.
Yeah.
Because you don't need any assholes in that situation, because it'll go sour very quickly.
Absolutely.
Right.
And speaking of assholes, you know, if you look around the bus and you can't find the asshole, it's you.
Words of wisdom. So when you finally did join Whitesnake, because that was kind of an all-star band at that point in time when you came in to the Whitesnake situation.
Yeah, I, you know, 2 years later, after we basically passed on and they went on to record the 87 record with Ainsley Dombard on drums and John Sykes and Neil Murray.
Mm-hmm.
And it took about 2 years to do that. Then when it came time to actually start making the videos, we get the phone call from John Kalatner.
Mm.
You know, and by then, you know, we had Tommy and I, we had spent a couple of years trying to find basically a singer. I mean, you know, you can find just about everybody, but you know, a voice, you can't go to a Guitar Center and say, hey, you know, can you give me one of those voices like Paul Rogers and stick it in your throat? No, you can't
right.
do that.
Right.
You know, and so, yeah, we found great guitar players and great everything else, but that special singer, that special arena quality singer, we couldn't find one, you know. So when it came time to get the offer from Whitesnake to join the band, it was like, you know, a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
You got one of the greatest voices in
right.
the band. It's like, yeah.
Was because, you know, a lot of it band is chemistry, as we mm-hmm. discussed. How was the chemistry? Obviously, you and Tommy have it, but now you're going, you got Vivian Campbell and you got Adrian Vandenberg, and it's like kind of like I said, this
phenomenal.
Right on.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
I had from the first tour, the first couple of legs of the tour, we not only had the band in one bus, but we had the wives and girlfriends in one bus. And I got to tell you, it was the most fun I've ever had.
Wow.
It didn't last too long. Yeah. But while it did, it was wonderful.
Now, did you have the blonde hair before you joined? Because you had some blonde-ass hair. Yeah,
it was blonde. I was bored. I was laying by the pool putting sun in. And what you see on Still the Night, that's sun in.
Remember the sun in? How 80s is that, right?
Yeah. Well, the one
we used to use was lemon juice. If you put lemon juice in your hair, that'll get it nice and blonde.
Yeah. Well, I can see.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you can tell the change in sound quality because Rudy and I have been in show business for a long time. And sometimes, as the saying goes, shit happens. And we had a great interview a few months ago. And when we went to chop it up to air it, we found out that we lost about 20 minutes of it, Rudy.
Oh, my God.
So I figured let's just get back on the horn and we can pick up where we left off and continue on this great conversation that we had. And like you said, make it even better than the last one.
That's right. Let's do it.
Yeah. So where we were at is we were talking about you being a Whitesnake, and we were laughing about how your Cuban brown hair had gone completely blonde from the sun in that you had been using back in those days. But I wanted to ask you what it was like in Whitesnake when Steve Vai came in the band, kind of a different player than what you had been used to with Vivian Campbell and with Adrian Vandenberg.
Yeah, but you know what? Steve reminded me more of Randy Rhoads and the fact that he was very diverse and not necessarily blues rooted.
Right.
He's playing. So, of course, you know, having played with Randy Rhoads before in Quiet Riot and Ozzy, I was kind of used to playing with somebody that played at that specific level.
Was there a rumor at the time that Coverdale had kind of paid
Steve Vai like this huge amount of money, like a free agent on a football team or something on those lines to join Whitesnake. Did you hear anything about that? Is that true? Do you know?
You know, that is an interesting question. I was never involved in what the other members of the band, what they made.
Right.
Because, you know, we had incentives. It was not like a flat fee, like a salary thing.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Interesting.
Yeah. So, and, you know, I never saw it as my business, and I still don't. You know, with the people that I play with, I never really go into their finances or anything like that because it's none of my business.
Oh, sure, yeah. That was always the big rumor, though, that David Coverdale pays Steve Vai, like, you know, $1 million to come join Whitesnake.
Only a million? Oh, God. He got shortchanged.
So what kind of incentives would you have?
You know, percentages, things like that.
Okay, for like better, if the arena does more people or something along those lines?
Like I said, it was not a flat fee.
Yeah,
and,
gotcha.
And actually, we were given that deal even before the band recouped. Because when we joined the band, all of us, you know, Adrian and Tommy and Vivian and myself, the band was in a bit of a debt.
Gotcha.
You know, for recordings and anything else that came along with that. So once it was recouped, that's when that certain agreement kicked in.
Those bonuses kick in, right.
Yeah.
That's interesting because like we talked about earlier, you've always had a gig. You've played with so many people in so many different circumstances. And it's interesting to me after playing with Ozzy and Quiet Riot and then Whitesnake, and then you went on to play with two kind of different sides of the spectrum as far as what people perceive them to be, one being Ronnie James Dio, and the other one, which kind of blew me away at the time, was Yngwie Malmsteen. And which one was first? Was it Dio that you played with first or Malmsteen?
No, actually Malmsteen. As a matter of fact, I got a call to go in the studio to work on the Master of the Moon, the Dio record, while I was still touring with Yngwie. And I had to decline because I couldn't walk away from the Yngwie tour.
Right.
You know, so I told Wendy that if they still wanted me to, you know, interested in me joining the band, once I finished the tour with Yngwie, I will be available. And that's what happened.
How did you get the gig with Yngwie? That's an interesting kind of mix, being the bass player that you are, very rock solid with some cool little, you know, lots of cool little fills and stuff. But Yngwie is much more of the fast-fingered, neoclassical type stuff.
I'm full of surprises, just like you.
Is that a style of music that you had played, or did you just say, okay,
yeah,
I can do this?
Yeah, that was the style of music that I grew up playing. I grew up playing fusion and progressive rock, you know, back in the 70s when it was fashionable, you know. And then something happened at the end of the 70s. That type of music was frowned upon, and it became more glam rock and a little bit more, you know, sensible to the ears, I guess.
Right.
But I still listen to that. I mean, if you know, when I go to the gym, all I listen to is prog rock, you know, prog and fusion.
Right,
you
know? Right. So was it kind of a cool, not a challenge, but I mean, playing with Yngwie, I mean, there's a lot of work to be done to get those parts played.
For me personally, it was a total musical enema. You know, getting to play as many notes as you can.
Right.
You know, the license to play as many notes as you can without anybody saying backstage, hey, what are you doing, man?
He's right. Because usually, you know, the bass player has to hold down the fort in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, but these are songs that are written for a specific purpose, and that is to showcase musicianship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a few bands that actually base their whole career on music like that. Rush being one of them.
Sure.
You know, come to mind. And even, you know, the bands that, let's say, Billy Sheehan is involved with. You know, he's not really known for a guy who's just holding down the bottom, you know. So, you know, the music gets written around to showcase the musicianship.
Mm-hmm. Did you enjoy playing with Yngwie?
Oh, very much so. Oh, I really did. Really, really did. He's great, and got to meet his family, you know, April.
Mm-hmm.
He manages the band. And and Antonio, you know, his son. He was just a little kid. I saw him a few years ago, and he said he's a grown man now. But I remember, you know, in the morning, kind of like babysitting with him in the bus and watching cartoons and feeding him some cereal and stuff like that. So it was great. It was really pretty much a family atmosphere.
I mean, you've had the pleasure of playing with so many great guitar players, from Randy to Carlos Cavazo, and you're talking about Adrian Vandenberg and Vivian, Steve Vai and Malmsteen. Who was the best out of all of them? I think I'm pretty sure what you're going to say.
I think who do you think?
Well, I mean, it's interesting to me because the two game changers is Randy Rhoads, and then a few years later, Malmsteen kind of being a combination of Randy Rhoads and Ritchie Blackmore. So I would think you're probably going to say Randy.
Well, Randy, you know, Randy is in a league all by himself. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, he accomplished so much in such a short time. And of course, his potential was cut off by him passing. You know?
Right.
So, I mean, I could see a glimpse of where that was going.
Right.
Absolutely. Because people, as a reference, they have the records, Blizzard and Diary. But he passed away about a year to a year and a half after those records. And then what happened is, in between, he was growing so fast as a musician. It was
right.
just incredible. And a composer, you know, so I could definitely see that he went into a more progressive direction with his music. You know, I mean, if you listen to the track Diary of a Madman and compare that to, let's say, Steal Away the Night,
right.
you know, there's musically, as far as the composition goes, there's so much more complexity
mm-hmm.
to it, you know.
Let me ask you a question that just popped in my head. You mentioned that Randy was composing and stuff. Did he ever at all play anything for you before he passed away, like when you're on tour or in sound check or something, like some kind of a riff that he'd been working on? Was there anything like that?
You know, that's interesting. We used to share the same, you know, tuning room,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so when he was warming up, he would warm up to classical music.
Right.
With a classical guitar. So he was just basically tuning in his classical chops,
mm-hmm.
you know. So that was his goal at the time, just to get better, not only at reading, because, you know, from playing rock and roll for such a long time, he wasn't up to speed with his reading as much as he wanted to. And being on tour gave him the opportunity to do that. You know, because he was preparing to go into the session scene and, you know, recording session, guitar recording session scene in New York.
Okay.
He was looking forward to getting into that as soon as that tour ended.
Gotcha. So to answer the question from earlier, is he your favorite that you played with, the best you played with?
I thought I was going to get out of that one.
Are they all good?
and again, taking Randy out of the equation and everything, the guy that really had the most musical depth, and I'm saying this because this happens to be a musician that came from classical piano and fell in love with the guitar. And as he tells me, because we played together, he fell in love with George Lynch's guitar sound.
Hmm.
That would be Tony McAlpine.
Oh, wow.
Yes, he was, I mean, again, taking Randy Rhoads out of the equation, but by bringing in Tony McAlpine, and you're talking about somebody who dedicated his life to learning Chopin, all the etudes, this massive musical vocabulary. And what he did is he transferred his musical knowledge from the piano, classical piano, to the guitar.
And that was it Project Driver? Was that the
Project
name of the record?
Driver, yes. And, you know, Tony spent a lot of time living with me in my house. And when we were, you know, putting together a driver, you know, Project mm-hmm. Driver, just the same as Tommy did. Tommy lived with us, too. So, I mean, I got to spend a lot of time with him. And you could tell, you could ask Tony, listen, play me this song. And he would just instantly play it.
Hmm.
Exactly. It's, yeah. Yeah, he's I think, you know, I mean, again, taking Randy out of the equation,
sure.
I think he would be the closest guy to a genius that I've ever, you know, played with.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. And it's like you mentioned, too, playing with Tommy Aldridge as well. You guys played in a lot of bands together, had some great chemistry there as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I played with Tommy for a long, long time. And you know what? And I wish that I could have get the chance to play with him now,
mm-hmm.
because I'm a better bass player now than I was.
Yeah, man, I'd love to one day have Ozzy call you and do Tommy Aldridge, Rudy Sarzo, Ozzy, and Zakk Wylde.
Oh, you know what? Everybody that's in that band, in the Ozzy band, deserves to be there. They're, you know, especially Blasco.
Mm.
You know, he's a friend of mine, and I like I told him in the past, he's the keeper of the key to everything Ozzy, and very, very fantastic job he's done with that.
Let's talk about you mentioned you played with Dio, kind of one of the guys that got to play with both Ozzy and Ronnie James Dio. What are the differences between the two of them as frontmen? Because they're both great frontmen, but kind of in different ways.
Well, you know, they both created different Sabbath eras. You know, mm-hmm. you have the Ozzy era, and then you have the Dio era, and they're both very different. And I got to tell you, Ronnie had so much respect for Ozzy. Do you know that song, King of Rock and Roll?
Yeah.
He wrote it for Ozzy.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I was very surprised to hear that from Ronnie himself.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah. So he definitely had a lot of respect for him, you know.
Hmm.
And I think, you know, with time, it became mutual respect, too. I mean, they both understood that they brought something into a band that was so close to the heart. That's another thing. I asked Ronnie, of all the bands you've ever been in, what's the one you're the most proud of? Straight out, he said Black Sabbath.
Really?
Yeah. Without a doubt. And this is before Heaven and Hell got back together again.
Mm-hmm.
So I really understood why he jumped on when they called him to do it, you know, to do Heaven and Hell. Because I knew that two things. He had unfinished business with them, you know.
Yeah.
And also, that was his proudest moment.
Hmm. To play with him, because you were with Dio in his solo band up until his passing, correct?
Yes, I was with Ronnie from 2004 until the day he passed away.
Because he was doing Heaven and Hell stuff, but he still was keeping the Dio band going as well, right?
Absolutely, we would go on the road. And during breaks, during Heaven and Hell breaks, we would go on the road, and especially in Scandinavia, you know, every year, because he wanted to do that for the Dio fans. He wanted them to know that he hadn't forgotten about them and that he was proud of them and all of that. So every single year, we would go out as Dio. As a matter of fact, I was doing a few weeks ago a Comic Con convention at the last place that Heaven and Hell actually performed, and I was there to witness it.
Hmm.
It was at the Showboat Hotel in Atlantic City. The House of Blues is there, actually. It's still there,
mm-hmm.
but it's not operating. And that was the last show that Heaven and Hell did. The last time Ronnie played was at our Dio rehearsal, November 16th, 2009. And that day he was diagnosed with, you know, that there's something wrong. I mean, the doctors in L.A. weren't completely certain that it was cancer. So they told him, listen, you must go immediately, you know, to take care of this, and they recommended Houston, you know, all the cancer clinics out there. And six months of the date, he passed away in May.
Wow. 15th. So you were there for his, like, last rehearsal?
Yes, yes. We were getting ready to, again, go out on tour for what became known as the Christmas Dio tour
mm.
In Scandinavia, England, and so on, Europe, you know.
Right. Now, you had told me before, we never talked about it, but did you show Ronnie how to use Pro Tools and that sort of a thing?
Yeah, they were using it at the time, but actually we switched over to Pro Tools from a different program that he was using and implementing MIDI into it. Because at the time they were doing drums in real time, you know, which became a little bit of a problem trying to edit and sync everything properly.
Right.
And so it just took like maybe, you know, a couple of days to get Ronnie up to speed. And from that point on, he was on his own. I would show up at his house and go down to his studio and he would say, check this out, kid, and play me like a completed song, you know, because, you know, he's a bass player. He's a musician, you know.
Right.
He grew up playing trumpet. He reads music. You know, he was the most complete vocalist / musician that I work with. You know, because he was, you know, he played everything. Yeah, he could play keyboards, he played guitar, he played, of course, the bass. But Simon would program the drums for him.
Gotcha, okay.
You know, and then, you know, he would play me all these new songs, you know, and it was like amazing. And some of them wound up on the Heaven and Hell record. And they were actually meant to be on the Elektra albums.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, so he was a good student then.
Oh, yeah. No, he wasn't really a student. I mean, I was just showing him, you know, pointers. This is how he's done it in this software, because he already had knowledge of you know, recording on a computer. It was just a matter of transferring that to the new, you know, to the new system, you know, using Pro Tools.
When you were on stage playing with Dio, when you were, like, in your mix, did you have a lot of Dio vocals in the mix, or do you...
Oh, always.
Yeah.
Oh, he was so loud. It was incredible. And if you look at any of the photos, I'm really standing pretty close to him, you know, and his monitors were cranking. Yeah. Yes. Look, if you're playing with Ronnie on stage, that's the thing you want to hear the most.
Was that cool for you to keep?
That's the main reason why you're there.
You know? Does that help you lock in better, though, when you hear his vocal rather than going in with the drums or whatever?
Oh, believe me, Simon Wright is very loud too, and it was a beautiful mix. But you definitely want to hear Ronnie. I mean, because you know, there's just the way that Ronnie sings that kind of like conducts the mood of what you're going to be playing and how you're going to be playing it.
Right.
You know, it's almost like, you know, his lyrics are so cinematic that the music becomes the soundtrack to a movie.
Right.
And it's, you know, he's conducting it with his emotion.
You know, it's interesting because you were talking with Simon. I've been listening to The Dash, your podcast,
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, are you enjoying doing that?
I'm loving it, and you are one of my inspirations for doing it.
Why is that?
Because I've done a few podcasts with you, you know, radio shows, and I've always enjoyed the experience so much. You know, that every time I would leave the studio, I would go, wow, I wish I could do more of these.
Yeah.
So I could get that feeling, you know.
And so you decided to do one of your own, which has been a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun.
There's a great story. I really enjoyed the one that you did with Frankie Benali for obvious reasons. You guys, longtime friends and in Quiet Riot together. There's a story that you told that I'd like you to tell involving Ringo Starr, you and Frankie Benali.
Yes. Which one do you want to know?
Well, you lived in his house.
Oh, yeah, we did. Yeah. But then we actually got to meet him. I mean, he didn't know that we were there. We were just keeping his personal secretary company. And we were homeless anyway, so it was a perfect combination.
Hold on a second. How did you end up at Ringo Starr's personal secretary's? What happened?
Well, if you hang out at the Rainbow enough times, you're going to do stuff like that. Especially back then. I don't know what it's like anymore, but back in the 70s. I mean, Ringo used to hang out at the Rainbow. Everybody did.
Right,
you know,
right.
That was like the social network.
Mm-hmm.
You live in L.A., you know. Yeah.
So tell us the story. So you met him or you met his secretary?
Oh, no. I never met him at the Rainbow. I met his secretary while Ringo was out of town filming a movie. I believe it was Caveman.
Okay.
Yeah. And so the place, you know, it was the secretary and Wingo's girlfriend at the time before he met Barbara Bach, where actually he met her in the, making this movie.
Okay, you know, right. Yeah, Caveman. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you were just hanging out there and then you left? Or how did you ever actually meet him?
Well, actually, I think he was renting the house because the lease was up. And then what he did is he actually bought Mama Cass's house, Woodrow Wilson Drive. This is in the mid-70s, you know. Ringo spent most of his time in Monaco, even around that time, for tax purposes.
Okay. So he bought the house, and then so you just kind of you lived in that house.
No. We lived in the Sunset Plaza Drive house, which is a house that he was leasing, and then he moved to Woodrow Wilson Drive, which is the you know the old Mama Cass house.
Yeah,
and he bought that house, but we helped him move. So Frankie and I, we were movers for Ringo for one day.
Is that when you got to meet him?
Yes. We hung out. He was very, very nice. Super nice. I mean, you know, just a regular guy. But he just happened to be Ringo. You know?
Yeah, right. Hanging out with a couple rocker skids from the Rainbow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and at the end of the day, he gave us $20. And we looked at the bill and we said, we're never going to spend this. This is going to be our lucky, you know, $20. And by that night, we spent it on pizza.
You had no money left at that point anyways, right?
You know, it didn't matter.
You know? Well, Rudy, as we wind down here, we mentioned you're playing with the Guess Who. You guys just released your new record. It's a cool title. The future isn't what it used to be.
Yeah, the future ain't what it used to
be. Ain't what it used to be.
Yeah.
And you guys are gigging all the time. It's on Instagram, you guys are always playing around. It seems like you're quite busy.
Yeah, we are very busy. And, we love playing the classics.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like we have to play them. No, it's like, you know, I'm in the Guess Who, so I can play all those great songs.
Right, yeah, exactly.
I mean, what's the point of being in the band if you're not going to get to play all those, you know, the songs that I grew up with? But also, you know, there's some really great songs on the new record, so we sprinkle them with the set. Sometimes we do at least three, sometimes four songs, you know, from the new record. And the audience, they love them because there was a lot of effort made into keeping the spirit of what the Guess Who is known for within the new music.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And what would you say the Guess Who was known for?
You know, it was a combination of Canadian and Americana.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, the guys are from Canada anyway, so, you know, it's naturally for them to be able to capture that musical style. But also, it's very Americana also. You know, I would say almost like modern country.
Well, you're an honorary Winnipegger now too, because that's where the Guess Who is from.
Yes, and you being the mayor of Winnipeg.
I hope so. Last couple of questions for you. I wanted to know if this is true as well. I'd heard that Ozzy, when you guys were touring, used to be obsessed with the song by Phil Collins, "In the Air Tonight."
Yeah, whatever it was, you being a musician, you know this. There's usually a preferred song that the front of house guy likes to use to tweak the PA system.
Yeah.
From venue to venue.
Right.
Back in the day, they used to have this white noise thing that they would put through the speakers just to make sure the whole system is working properly, and they would measure it with some kind of an instrument, you know.
Right.
And they would look at it at a graph. So Something in the Air Tonight was that song that the front of house guy used every single day before we did, you know, right before we did sound check.
Gotcha. So one of Ozzy's favorites?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it became favorite because, you know, that song, every time I hear it now, it takes me back to doing sound check with Ozzy and Randy and Tommy, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I told you that shirt that I got the other day, which says Osborne and Rhodes and Sarzo and Aldridge. It's just a great...
Yes, I'm getting that shirt for Christmas for all my friends. You got one already. Oh, as a matter of fact, I'm sending you a special shirt.
Oh, great. Thank you. A Rudy Sarzo shirt, I hope.
Yes, it is.
last question for you, Rudy. With all the bands you've played in, it's hard to say them all, but I'm going to choose Ozzy, Dio, and Quiet Riot. What were your favorite three songs to play? Like, what was your favorite song to play from Ozzy, from Quiet Riot, and from Dio?
Okay, very simple. I go by what I still remember.
Yeah.
I can play it at any moment. If I'll be like in the dead sleep, somebody wakes me up and say, okay, let's play Crazy Train, I Don't Know, and Mr. Crowley.
Okay.
I'm on.
You can do those three.
Yes, I do. Quiet Riot will definitely be Bang Your Head, Come On, Feel the Noise, and Believe It or Not, Thunderbird, because that's the song that I used to play with in Dubrow with Kevin. And that's how I was asked to record on the Quiet Riot record. I was only supposed to do one song.
Right.
That was Thunderbird. And I on that first session, I actually wound up playing like on half the record right there. And then I came back and I finished the rest of the songs. So it would say Thunderbird, Bang Your Head, and
Come On, Feel the Noise.
And Come On, Feel the Noise. With Dio, ooh, there's so many. I love the way that we did Heaven and Hell with Ronnie. Rainbow in the Dark, God, and Mob Rules. But those are not necessarily Dio songs, but we played a lot of Sabbath.
Yeah, sure. The Dio.
Oh, Gates of Babylon, if you're going to go for any Rainbow song.
Dude, you've played all the great songs. What about Guess Who? What's your favorite song for Guess Who to play?
Oh, okay. I love the whole set, but I got to tell you, Undone. It's such a unique song. You don't get to play kind of like bossa nova jazz.
That's true, yeah.
On stage too often, you know. And this I love the song. American Woman and No Sugar Tonight.
Do you guys ever play Running Back to Saskatoon?
No, we haven't yet, but we definitely been talking about that one.
It's funny, a Cuban guy from Miami playing a song about Saskatoon.
Well, listen, if I would have kept going from Miami to New Jersey, my next stop was going to be, you know, somewhere in Canada.
Yeah, up in Detroit, Toronto, anyways. Rudy, man, it's great to talk to you. Thank you for doing this, and I'm glad we're able to finish up properly, man.
Thank you, Chris.
We'll talk to you soon, man. I'll be waiting for my Rudy Sarzo shirt in the mail.
Yeah.
Cheers, brother.
Thank you. God bless.
God bless. Thank you.
All right, thanks to the legendary Rudy Sarzo for sitting with me in studio and then jumping back on the phone after we realized we lost half of that interview. It happens sometimes after 500 episodes. Once in a while, you hit some technical difficulties, but Rudy's a great, great guy and was happy to do it. Please check out Rudy's podcast, The Dash. Listen and subscribe at Apple Podcasts or on your favorite podcast app. Rudy talks to some cool musicians from all over the world. He just had Canadian rocker Sass Jordan on. And remember, speaking of Canada, Rudy's playing in the Guess Who. Their tour starts this Sunday, November 11th, Veterans Day in Miami, Florida. Go to theguesswho.com to get tickets. Rudy Sarzo on bass, one of the biggest pros and the best players you'll ever hear. Speaking of pros and great players, we are still on the road here in Australia. We are at Sydney at the Manning Saturday on November 10th. November 13th, Adelaide at the Gov. November 14th in Brisbane at the Triffid. And then the Judas Rising Tour goes back to North America, hitting Canada. Moncton, November 21st. 23rd in Halifax. 24th in Quebec City. 25th in Montreal at MTLS. And then Arne Pryor is sold out on the 26th. 27th, London at the London Music Hall. 28th of November, Toronto at the Rockpile. November 30th, Thunder Bay at Crocs. December 1st, Winnipeg, hometown show at the Burton Companies Theater. The 2nd is Regina at the Exchange. The 3rd is Edmonton at the Starlight Room. And then Calgary, Alberta at the Gateway, the final show of the Judas Rising Tour. Lots of big stuff coming up for Fozzy, though. It's been a great run. We thank you so much for coming. Go to FozzyRock.com for all tickets for the remaining Australia shows, all the Canadian shows, and all the Fozzy VIP packages are sold out. For Sydney, but there's still packages available for every other show. We hang out with you, we take some pictures with you, and we play a private mini concert just for the VIPs. So go to FozzyRock.com for all that information on how to make it happen. All right, have a great weekend. Coming up Wednesday, former WWE announcer and current New Japan Pro Wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly will be here. Remember, The Rock used to call him Hermie. Yeah. Telling a bunch of great stories about all the good times in the WWE and the rise of New Japan Pro Wrestling. Everything happening in the meantime, in between time. Have a great week. Stay hard. Stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs. And a big yeah, boy.